of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, December 5th, 2007, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
The U.S. Senate approves a free trade deal with Peru. Small farmers are up in arms over regulations governing leafy greens, and Bush faces a setback for his Iran war plans. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. The U.S. Senate overwhelmingly approved a bilateral trade agreement yesterday between the U.S. and Peru. As the first trade deal between an Andean nation and the United States, the Peru Trade Promotion Agreement, as it's called, will gradually phase out all tariffs on U.S. goods and products in Peru, while expanding access to Peruvian service markets. In legislatively approving the first trade deal of the year, Senate Democrats lent the agreement bipartisan support after revisions to the original proposal included labor and environmental standards. Critics contend that such measures in Peru will lack enforcement and do not ensure environmental standards and conservation. Opponents of the bill argue that despite small modifications to the bill, it will likely result in social stratification and instability. Emboldened by yesterday's vote, President Bush urged Congress to act quickly and favorably on a pending trade agreement with Colombia so as to counterbalance the regional influence of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Other bilateral trade agreements with Panama and South Korea await congressional approval. Joining us on the line this morning is Laura Carlson. She is the director of the Americas Program at the Center for International Policy. She is based in Mexico City, and she joins us live from there this morning. Welcome to Uprising, Laura.
Good morning, Sonali. Thank you for the invitation to be here.
So let's talk about the Free Trade Pact first. Of course, quite surprising for Democrats to come on board with this pact. And as I mentioned in the introduction, critics are saying that there is really no chance that any of the labor and environmental standards will actually be enforced in Peru. Is that accurate?
I don't know that there's no chance, but I've been monitoring NAFTA here in Mexico since the negotiations began. And in many senses, although the mechanisms are different now that they've put into the Peru agreement, the basic procedures are the same. And what we know from the NAFTA experience is that these procedures do not have teeth and they are not accessible to workers. For example, now with the International Labor Organization standards being used, they're fine standards. They're good standards. The problem is enforcement, of course. And that enforcement has to go through the national government. So you have a series of obstacles for workers to make any kind of a claim under these policies that we believe will make it very difficult, if not impossible, for them to make a real difference.
So what is the reaction of the Peruvian government been? I'm assuming it's favorable. And also, what is the reaction of Peruvian civil society been?
The Peruvian government has been pushing this very actively for a long time now, and the reaction has been, of course, very positive. Their feeling is that they will now go through and make the changes to the national legislation that's necessary always with these free trade agreements in order to finally implement them. The United States government demands that the countries that sign them then go ahead and change elements of their national legislation to agree with the treaty itself. This is one of the things that many critics have always brought up, the way that the treaty comes to be a form of legislation or a form of law that subordinates national policymaking. As far as civil organizations, many of the labor and environmental organizations have been against this, although there has been a broad part of public opinion that believes that with access to the U.S. market, there could be gains for Peru. this is one of the big myths of free trade agreements. And there are several very serious studies that show why this is going to be a serious disappointment in Peru as well. The cost of having access to that U.S. market is very high for developing countries because of everything that the free trade agreements require. And many of the promises are actually promises that remain on paper. Just to give one example, in Peru, 99% of all Peruvian companies are small and medium-sized industries. And these are the ones, again, that we know from NAFTA that will be hardest hit by competition from imports under a free trade agreement. And yet the promise is that they will be able to import goods that will help their businesses grow. And yet, in a recent study that a contributor to our program, the Peruvian economist Ariela Ruiz did, she found that these companies don't do that kind of importation.
Now, I understand that the trade with Peru from the U.S.'s perspective is relatively small, according to the L.A. Times, about $8 billion in 2006. Supporters of the agreement have portrayed it as important for fostering good relations, promoting democracy, and advancing U.S. security interests in Latin America, including countering the influence of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. This according to the L.A. Times. So is it possible that this free trade agreement is more about politics than the economy from a U.S. perspective?
Yes, I think it definitely is, because not only is it seen in the context of a geopolitical context of creating two camps, dividing Latin America down the middle between what they see as the Bush administration sees as a Chavez camp and a pro-U.S. camp, but it also pulls them into a relationship of greater dependency on the United States, which creates more political leverage in the region. And then one of the most difficult, and I think one of the most problematic effects of the way that they've broken down into free trade agreements with individual countries when it was impossible to have a single agreement with the entire Americas region because of very valid criticisms on the part of especially Peru and Argentina of the free trade agreement in the Americas, is that they've broken up what was formerly the Andean bloc. When Colombia and Peru entered into free trade agreement negotiations, then Venezuela left that bloc in protest because they eliminated the possibility of those countries banding together to have greater power to assert some of their own demands within these negotiations. The negotiations with both Peru and Colombia have been so lopsided that some of the national negotiators left in anger at the way that they were bullied, basically, by U.S. negotiators at different points in the negotiations. And the final agreement, although the Democrats claim it has significant modifications, is in effect a NAFTA-style free trade agreement still.
I'm speaking with Laura Carlson. She is the director of the Americas Program at the Center for International Policy. We're talking to her live from Mexico City. Let's talk about on the ground in Peru, the reactions of workers in particular. What do they expect is going to be happening, not just for their jobs, but also their families with the economy of Peru? As you've been discussing earlier, this is not going to bode well for most workers. What do you expect will happen over the next 10 to 15 years? Which is the time frame for the creation of the legislation in support of the agreement?
Well, the products that are going into the United States and are benefited under this agreement are basically primary sector products like asparagus or candies or flowers and other products that have very little added value. And in exchange for that, the nation is forced to accept laws that will limit access to health care because of limitations on generic medicines, and that will deepen the income gap in the region as it has in the other countries. In addition, there's the expectation from serious economic studies that as the United States begins to sign other free trade agreements with other developing countries, then some of what are seen as preferences now in access to the United States market will no longer be preferable. And so what you're left with is a set of legal norms that force you into a situation that we know privileges the transnational corporations and large companies within the nation. as the small and medium industries, and small farmers in particular, the weaker sectors in competing in this kind of a context, go out of business, you have higher unemployment, and you may even have a kind of a plateau in terms of economic growth. These are the effects that we've seen in Mexico so far. So this could be a very, very difficult situation for Peru in the medium and long term, as it creates a situation of greater instability in a nation that has been experiencing economic growth recently, but also has severe problems of poverty and instability due to still weak democratic institutions.
Laura, I'm wondering if you're at all following the debates, presidential debates here in the United States, and particularly the discussions around free trade agreements. Of course, as I mentioned, Democrats were more Democrats lent their support to this free trade agreement. In fact, allowing it to pass, Senators Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama voted for it, while a few others opposed it. Joseph Biden, Christopher Dodd opposed it, John Edwards has put out a statement against it. What do you think what role do you think these free trade agreements, the one with Peru and also the coming ones with Colombia and Panama, what role do you think they'll play in the presidential debates here in the United States, if any role at all?
I think and hope, actually, that the issue of trade will be important in the presidential debates, because it's certainly something that representatives are hearing from among their constituencies. In fact, in the House vote, it was far more split within the Democratic Party. It was a 285-132 vote margin. And there were far more Democrats that voted against it, many of them incoming ones who are hearing from constituencies that they have serious questions about this model of trade. The Democratic leadership has been the proponent, especially of this Peru agreement, saying that they have won significant modifications from the Bush administration on the NAFTA model, and that they believe that these modifications will change some of the outcomes and will alleviate some of the criticisms of job loss both in the United States and eventually in the partner countries as well. However, I think that the Democratic leadership on this point has fallen into a trap that's been carefully set by the Bush administration to say, support this model of free trade agreement or you're against international trade. That simply is not true. There's a lot of other options of how international trade can be regulated and can be promoted that do not have to be a very rigid and a very comprehensive free trade agreement model along the lines of NAFTA. So we're encouraging the Democrats and the Democratic leadership to think more creatively about this, to be a little more responsive to the constituencies. We know that trade was one of the reasons that we have a Democratic Congress right now, and to begin to think outside the box, and certainly outside the FTA box, about how we can have a truly new trade policy. And hopefully this will become an issue in the Democratic debates and an issue that a new president will respond to.
Finally, Laura, let's talk about Colombia. President Bush is quoted as saying that the biggest fear for stability in South America is if the United States Congress rejects a free trade agreement with Colombia. Clearly, of course, the United States has had long-standing military ties with the Colombian government. What do you think will happen with the free trade agreement with Colombia? Is Peru basically just a precedent for Colombia, Panama, and the other agreements still pending?
In the first place, that kind of a statement by President Bush is an alarmist statement and should be rejected as a form of coercion. In Colombia, the Peruvian agreement may somewhat pave the road, but the Democrats have been very clear that Colombia faces far more obstacles in passage in approval of a free trade agreement than Peru. In fact, there was sort of a sense that we'll let Peru go through to show that we're not against trade, but these other three have very little possibilities. Of course, the reason in Colombia is the human rights record, and in particular, the huge number of assassinations of labor leaders. In that context, to foment trade and give what many consider a privileged access to the U.S. market cannot be morally justified. It's not, the free trade agreement has actually, I believe, could exacerbate instability in Colombia for the same reasons that we've mentioned, that these agreements, and everyone from the World Bank and proponents of the agreements to critics agree on this aspect, exacerbate inequality. And when you have greater inequality and a greater gap between the haves and the have-nots, you invariably have a situation of greater social instability.
Well, Laura Carlson, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, as always, and we will certainly continue to follow the story with Colombia.
Well, thank you. It's been good to be here.
Laura Carlson is director of the Americas program at the Center for International Policy, speaking to us live from Mexico City. We've been discussing the approval of the U.S.-Peru Free Trade Agreement. Later in the hour, we'll be joined in studio by Professor Mohamed Sahimi to talk about the U.S. intelligence report on Iran. We'll also hear this radical day in history. After this short break, we'll find out why the agricultural industry would like to get in your salad bowl. Stay tuned.
Tomorrow, Radio Intifada will bring you a special commemorating the 20th anniversary of the First Intifada, the Palestinian nonviolent popular uprising against Israeli occupation. A look into what the prospects are for a just peace for Palestinians and Israelis. That's tomorrow afternoon at 3. Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman is coming up at 9. Keep it tuned. This is Uprising.
Hello, my name is Sergio Monteiro. I was born in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, and I have been living in the United States since 1973, but I keep intact my mother culture. It follows that I'll be particularly concerned with the issues regarding the Latino community, for example, immigration. I'm a professor of physics, and politically I'm a left-wing. Regarding the board, it is my opinion that many, perhaps most of the problems at KPFK arise from it being a democratic institution. The problems, quote-unquote, are therefore good and welcome. This is similar to academic departments in any university, and I have plenty of experience to help the board to work together. In a nutshell, I bring to the board a voice for the Latino community, and I bring my experience as a professor to solve problems in a democratic institution.
Learn more about KPFK elections at pacificaelections.org. Your completed ballot must be received at the P.O. Box or the station by midnight, December 11th.
People, the time.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, December 5th in 1848, U.S. President James K. Polk addressed the U.S. Congress, confirming that large amounts of gold had been discovered in California. This announcement led to the California Gold Rush and immediately increased immigration and westward migration in America. Soon after, the easily accessible gold was gone and the competition rose, greed took its toll. California passed a foreign miners tax, and Americans began organizing a tax on foreign miners, particularly Latino and Chinese miners. The population boom in California began to drive the Native Americans even further from their land. When they responded by trying to protect their homes, the American miners committed acts of genocide on Native villages, often leaving no survivors. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Welcome back to Uprising. A recent amendment by California Senator Dianne Feinstein to the 2007 Farm Bill on leafy greens had family farmers up in arms. Feinstein has proposed regulating all leafy green vegetable production in the United States, a move which could negatively impact thousands of traditional leafy green farmers, in particular organic and sustainable farmers. As a result, the amendment could effectively eliminate access to local leafy greens nationwide. Instead of consulting with small and organic farmers, Feinstein vetted her amendment with an industry association, which helped to create the California Leafy Green Marketing Agreement, or LGMA, guidelines. The LGMA was crafted in reaction to the 2006 E. coli outbreaks, which resulted in more than 200 illnesses and 3 deaths. But the approach of Feinstein and large commercial leafy greens producers makes no distinction between pre-cut industrially produced bagged salads and traditional whole grains available at most health food stores and farmers markets. Earlier this week, the U.S. Department of Agriculture accepted public comment on its proposal to handle regulations of leafy green products under the Agricultural Marketing Agreement Act of 1937. Joining me on the line this morning is Judith Redmond. She is the board president of Community Alliance with Family Farmers and co-owner of Full Belly Farms. Welcome to Uprising, Judith.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Yeah.
So first, explain to our listeners what the California Leafy Green Marketing Agreement is, this set of guidelines that was created by an industry association.
That's correct. And it's a group of sort of lobbyists that have larger farms, mostly in California and Arizona, growing all kinds of different vegetables. And they needed to respond to that outbreak of this really severe pathogen, E. coli 0157. It's sort of a superbug that has become endemic in our environment. And so what they did was they codified this set of rules that farmers would have to follow that they thought might prevent the harvest from the farm containing the pathogen, so that when it went to the processing plant, you know, they were hoping there would be less danger of disease. Hmm. But some of the rules, you know, are being used in the Salinas Valley and in other parts of California to tell farmers, you know, that they can't use compost, that they can't have animals on their farm, even to the extent one of the buyers groups has published rules where they even think that visitors, before they arrive on the farm, should be given identification tags and have to read the food safety protocols for the farm before they're even allowed on the fields. And the rules say things like these rules must be enforced on farms with locked gates. So it's a very it's an approach to food safety that we think isn't going to be very practical. It's certainly not environmentally friendly, and we don't think it's going to work after having really studied the situation.
Now, Judith, what is the difference between bagged salads and whole leafy greens that you could buy, you know, whole heads of lettuce that you buy, say, at a farmer's market?
Well, the bagged salad market is one that has grown very quickly in the last 20 years because it's so convenient. People can buy those bags and they say ready to eat. And so people in food service, you know, in restaurants where when you get salad and so forth, a lot of that goes to that restaurant all ready to eat. The tomatoes have been chopped, the lettuce has been chopped, and they don't need to even wash it in the restaurant. They simply put it on your plate. So it's extremely convenient, and that industry has grown very, very fast, very, very quickly. And that industry, basically, on most of the farmers that apply for that industry are rather they grow their crops on large fields. They harvest the entire field all at once, take it quickly, usually in a refrigerated truck, to the processing plant, where it's then essentially processed, but it's not processed like a can of tomato sauce, where that can of tomato sauce has a long shelf life. It's a little different than that, in that it probably, they say, has a 16 or 17-day shelf life. It's been treated with a lot of chlorine in the wash water, even when it's organic. And so it's a sort of processed vegetable, but with a shelf life of maybe 16 or 17 days. And what what we found is that the most of the outbreaks of this really severe pathogen, which can kill people at very low doses occasionally, most of the outbreaks of it of that pathogen are associated with these bagged greens. That is not to say that there might not be outbreaks from a small farm or a farm providing the heads of lettuce to the local farmers market, but it has not been shown in the data, and we've scoured the FDA and the CDC websites to try and find. They can actually trace outbreaks down to three people. We feel like there, and the FDA has actually published a lot of data saying that there are higher risks associated with this 17-day shelf life of salad in these bags, treated with chlorine, basically product from many different farms being put together in one big tub. All kinds of characteristics of that industry mean that it may have a higher risk. So that's the answer. That's the difference between the chard that you buy or the lettuce that you buy at the farmer's market. You know the farmer. And even if you buy it at Whole Foods or your local grocery store, a lot of times there's a very short distance between you and the farmer. Whereas in these multi-state outbreaks where you're buying bagged greens, you have, you know, it could have probably come from there, you know, any one of 30 different potential farms and was then mixed together. So the tracing back of where it came from takes some time. It can be done now. They've got these trace back programs, but it can take, you know, a week to really figure out where those greens might have come from.
Now, Judith, is it also, you know, the fact that you have salad that's bagged in plastic and sealed, is that also a problem to create an environment for bugs like E. coli?
Like this, most E. coli, of course, is beneficial, but this pathogenic one, mm-hmm. Yes, they think that that might be one of the factors in why there are these elevated risks associated with the bagged greens.
Hmm. So let's talk about the comment period that the USDA allowed the public to make comments on its proposal to handle regulation of leafy green products. I understand that your organization, the Community Alliance with Family Farmers, did submit a public comment. What is your approach to how these regulations should happen, and how is it different from the leafy green marketing agreement that was proposed by industry?
Great, thank you. I first need to just correct a little bit of information so that your listeners understand. Feinstein proposed an amendment and then withdrew it. Her amendment was going to be an amendment to the Farm Bill.
So she has withdrawn that, okay.
Pardon me?
She has withdrawn that amendment.
Well, as of our latest information, there are rumors that she's still considering it. But it was withdrawn very shortly after she submitted it, and then there's rumors now that she might be considering it again, but at the moment she has not submitted it. The comment period that you referred to is the U.S. Department of Agriculture is considering national rules that would govern how farmers farm from a national level, which is, to me, well... It just, farming is a very local activity, and to me, the idea of having centralized control over farmers, if you look at history and all over the world, it really hasn't worked very well. So the comment period that you referred to, it ended yesterday, Monday, and we did, yes, submit comments. A lot of our comments were to try to convince the USDA that this approach that they're taking isn't going to work very well. In terms of what we think should be done, we think that any rules that are written about food safety should not ask, they should be compatible with environmental stewardship. And we think that many of the practices that good stewards on farms are using, in fact, are very important in reducing the threat of these pathogenic outbreaks. For example, we think that healthy soil full of life, it's not just that we think this, there's research that shows this, it can actually reduce the colonization of the soil by pathogens. We think that having grassed areas between your field and any runoff from, say, a grazing area can prevent the passage of manure and E. coli onto your field. And there's a tremendous amount of research that shows that this is true. And these kinds of approaches should be incorporated into the food safety lexicon, because what's happening right now is this sort of thinking that says you have to clear the land, You can't have even any lizards. They actually say lizards and rodents. You can't have those on your farm. If you're audited, and that's what they're talking about, this is all about auditing the farm every year, and they find geese. This has happened in Salinas Valley. They find geese in your field. They say, plow in that crop. You cannot sell it. You had birds in your field. You must put out poison to kill those birds. So they're going in this completely wrong direction, and we're trying to point in a direction that's compatible with environmental regulation, compatible with environmental stewardship, and holistic. We also think that the public, the reason that it's really great you're having this program is that the public has a stake in this, not just in terms of water quality and food quality, but in terms also of health, because this pathogen is, in fact, endemic nowadays. It's found all over. It's like the superbugs that you find in hospitals. And we need to take something of a public health approach to controlling it rather than this approach on the farm that says, that sort of has an approach that has been proving not to work in the beef industry and we think will not work in the leafy greens industry. Hmm.
Well, Judith, finally, what do you think listeners can do about this? The USDA public comment period is over. Is there any other way in which listeners can get involved and, do the kinds of things that are environmentally friendly and protect not only the public health but the environment?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. This is sort of a new world for farmers right now. It's not going to end. It's a very serious. That's why we're taking it to our friends in the urban community. It's not like just one little shot. It's something that's going to be a pretty big deal. It's going to happen in tomatoes, melons, green onions, all of your vegetables. And if you want to eat vegetables that aren't doused in chlorine, coming from a processing plant. One of the things that you can do is you can get a lot of information right now at this one website where it's all been compiled, and it's on the website of the Community Alliance with Family Farmers, which you can go to if you go to www.caff.org, Community Alliance with Family Farmers.org, CAF.org. So that would be the first thing, and on that website, or you can be on our email list, and we'll just continue to send you information about how to support sort of the local food system, your local market, your local farmers, and all of these environmental values that are so important.
That's CAFF.org, CAFF.org. Judith Redmond, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for airing this program.
Judith Redmond is the board president of Community Alliance with Family Farmers. She's co-owner of Full Belly Farms. You are listening to Uprising, and after this short break, we will take a look at the latest U.S. intelligence report on Iran. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Rico Ross, and a candidate for the KPFK local station board. I'm a father, an actor, and an activist. I starred in Alien, Submission Impossible, and ER, to name a few. I'm a delegate for the 42nd Assembly District, African American Caucus member, and chair the Education Committee for the Progressive Caucus. I have a Bachelor's of Art and a Master's of Fine Art. There is nothing more important than true media reflecting the big picture. Having worked and lived abroad for 13 years in England, Japan, Bulgaria, South Africa, and more, gives me a unique perspective as a citizen of the world. I'm Rico Ross, and I ask for your vote.
Learn more about KPFK elections at pacificaelections.org. Your completed ballot must be received at the P.O. Box or the station by midnight, December 11th.
Welcome back to Uprising. In what appears to be a blow to the Bush administration's plans for war and sanctions on Iran, a U.S. intelligence report has asserted that Iran stopped its nuclear weapons program 4 years ago. The National Intelligence Estimate represents the consensus of all 16 American spy agencies. In October, President Bush warned that Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons could, quote, ignite World War III. Reacting to the report earlier this week, Bush called the report a warning signal, not grounds for reassurance, and refused to renounce a military option for Iran. His allies, Britain and France, lined up behind him. According to British PM Gordon Brown, the report confirms we were right to be worried about Iran seeking to develop nuclear weapons. Other reactions to the report were quite the opposite. Mohamed El-Baradei, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, said the report should help to defuse the current crisis over Iran's nuclear program and called for swift negotiations to bring an end to the standoff between Iran and the West. For its part, the Iranian government said it welcomed what it called a United States decision to correct its claim of an active Iranian nuclear weapons program. An interesting twist on this story comes from Robert Baer, a former CIA field officer writing for Time.com, who concludes that Bush backed the report's findings as it allowed him a face-saving way out of an unfeasible war. Joining me in studio this morning is Mohamed Sahimi, a professor of chemical engineering at the University of Southern California. Welcome to Uprising, Professor Sahimi.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Sonali.
Thanks very much for joining us. So first, this report and its results, were you at all surprised when you heard about it?
I am actually not surprised at all, because all the objective experts who, instead of listening to Bush administration propaganda or even listening to what the Iranian government was saying, had been studying the reports of International Atomic Energy Agency about Iran's nuclear program, knew that there was no evidence that Iran actually had a nuclear weapon program before or after 2003. So I'm not surprised at all. The National Intelligence Estimate said that Iran did have a nuclear weapon program before 2003, but I interpret that as a concession by the intelligence community to the Bush administration, because even before 2003, there was no evidence that Iran had any nuclear weapon program. What happened was Iran in 1983 decided to have an uranium enrichment program and asked the International Atomic Energy Agency to help set it up, which Iran was entitled to. The agency actually did send a team to Tehran in 1983 and studied the issue and issued a report saying that Iran does need a program for uranium enrichment, and suggested the way the agency could help Iran to set it up. So Iran was trying to set that program in full transparency and with the help of International Atomic Energy Agency. But the United States blocked that effort. Iran in the subsequent years, for at least 2 years, tried to do that again in full transparency, seeking help with other countries, but each time that it was close to an agreement, the United States blocked it again. So Iran learned its lesson, decided to quietly set up the uranium enrichment program on its own. But that effort that was quiet until 2003 wasn't illegal, because Iran's only obligation to International Atomic Energy Agency was that if it set up any nuclear facility for uranium enrichment, the only obligation that it had was to inform the agency 180 days before introducing any nuclear material into the facilities. And therefore, Iran duly did that in February 2003. So the fact that the National Intelligence estimates that Iran had a nuclear program, nuclear weapon program before 2003, only means that they didn't know that what Iran was doing, and therefore they interpreted that as Iran having a nuclear weapon program, whereas there is no hard evidence that Iran actually had the program before 2003. So I'm not surprised at all.
Now, what about the way in which the Bush administration and its allies in Britain and France are reacting to this report? I mean, this is the definitive, you know, consensus of all 16 American intelligence agencies, and yet the Bush administration is saying that this should not be interpreted as anything other than a warning signal, that we should, you know, and the British PM saying that it actually confirms we were right to be worried about Iran.
Well, as far as the Bush administration is concerned, the confrontation with Iran and the war that it has been waging in the Middle East are ideological wars. And whenever you act according to ideology rather than on the physical facts on the ground, you don't let physical facts on the ground to get in your way. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you can interpret things any way you want. So that's basically what I expected the administration to say that. As for France and England, they have always wanted to find Iran guilty, and they had already issued their verdict that Iran is guilty of having a nuclear weapon program. And now that the National Intelligence Estimate is against what they had already decided before deciding based on evidence, they have to face safe and say, well, we were right all along. Iran did have a nuclear weapon program before 2003, and therefore there is reason to be alarmed about it.
What do you think of the story on Time.com by Robert Baer saying that the Bush administration basically needed a way out of waging war with Iran because it just looked so unfeasible, and that he knew of this intelligence report before it was issued? He would have Smith had to have known, and that he signed off on it. And now it allows him a diplomatic face-saving way to have, you know, to avoid the Iran war.
I think it's plausible, the report by Robert Barr is plausible. The fact of the matter is there was increasing evidence from all sides that a military attack on Iran would not lead to anything other than chaos and war and bloodshed in the Middle East. Iranians would have reacted to any military attack, and they would have reacted strongly. The price of oil is already close to $90 per barrel, and therefore any military attack would have raised the price beyond anybody's imagination. Iranians would have reacted by attacking U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf and oil fields in Saudi Arabia. They do have a lot of assets spread throughout the Middle East to strongly react to any military attack. At the same time, we know that there has been some report that even the military brass was against military attack on Iran. Admiral William Fallon, the commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East, has been quoted as saying that no war with Iran will happen on his watch. So given the opposition within the Joint Chief of Staff, the military brass, and given the impracticality of staging any military attack on Iran and achieving the goal that the administration supposedly had, I would not be surprised that if the report by Robert Barr is actually is true.
I want to remind our listeners, I'm speaking with Mohammed Sahimi. He joins us in studio. He's a professor of chemical engineering at the University of Southern California. And we're talking about the latest U.S. intelligence report that revealed that Iran has not had a nuclear weapons program in at least a few years. And despite that, of course, the Bush administration, at least publicly, claiming that they were right to be worried about Iran. What about the reaction from within Iran? It must be a sort of a triumphant time in Iran, particularly from the government right now. I understand there's a lot of discussion on the state television, you know, saying, look, we were right after all.
Yes, of course. In fact, I talked to state television, the English language part of it, yesterday, and they were elated about the new report. Iran's foreign minister, Manoucher Mottaki, had a hard time hiding his happiness about the new report. And President Ahmadinejad this morning declared that this is a triumph for Iran and Iranian people. So they have been saying that Iran's nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. They have been saying that we don't have any weapon program. They have been saying that there is a religious verdict against making nuclear weapon in Iran. And therefore, they have been saying all this all along. But as I said at the beginning of what I said, we didn't have to listen to what they said. All we had to do was study the reports of International Atomic Energy Agency, the only objective source of information on Iran's nuclear program, that declared report after report that there is absolutely no evidence that Iran has any nuclear weapon program, secret or parallel nuclear weapon program. And all there is all those declared facilities that are under monitoring and inspection of the agency. So if we wanted to base our judgment on the agency's report, we could have reached this conclusion long time ago and not just this past week.
Now, I know that you mentioned earlier that the U.S.'s war plans for Iran have an ideological basis, but still, how do you respond to, you know, Stephen Hadley, the National Security Advisor, saying that this new intelligence estimate shows that international pressure has had an effect on Iran? See, well, look, you know, we applied pressure and Iran did actually respond to it.
That's actually not true, because suppose that Iran did have a nuclear weapon program, a secret nuclear weapon program, and it stopped it in 2003. In 2003, there was no economic sanction against Iran. Mm-hmm. In 2003, there was no pressure on Iran. In fact, in 2003, Iran and the European Union were negotiating about how to settle this issue, and Iran had agreed to suspend its uranium enrichment program as a result of a negotiation with the European Union. So The making the claim that it was a pressure of sanction and it was a pressure of international community that Iran stopped its nuclear program is totally not credible. Yes, if the National Intelligence Estimate had declared that Iran stopped its nuclear weapon program last month or a few months ago, then we could have thought that there is some credibility or it is plausible that Iran did it. But the fact that they said they did it back in 2003, which coincidentally is the same time that Iran announced to the International Atomic Energy Agency the existence of uranium enrichment program, which was carried out according to its obligation to the agency because Iran wanted to introduce nuclear material into the facilities, tells me that there is no credibility to what Stephen Hadley has said.
Now, assuming that the Bush administration does still intend to create a case for Iran, what impact will this intelligence report have, and could it, in your mind, effectively squelch any military feasibility? I mean, given what happened with Iraq, that the use of flawed intelligence was the excuse for invading Iraq, this time they are not going to be able to use the issue of an intelligence report, it seems.
Absolutely not. If the administration tries to come up with some sort of excuse for military attack on Iran, it will be totally isolated, not only in the international community, but even within the United States. I think it will make it practically impossible to get authorization from the Congress for staging any military attack on Iran. All the presidential candidates have already criticized President Bush very harshly about his rhetoric and about using things at the start of World War III if Iran acquires even the knowledge for making nuclear bomb, which, by the way, is very absurd and ridiculous claim, because if you go to the internet, you can easily find all the information that you need for making a nuclear weapon. So acquiring the knowledge is not any excuse to attacking a country like Iran. And so I believe the new national intelligence estimate would make it very difficult, if not impossible, for the administration to find any excuse, any justification whatsoever to try to attack Iran.
Professor Sahimi, what about, on the same note, what about the sanctions on Iran that the United Nations, that European officials were seeking at the United Nations Security Council? Will this report, you think, also impact their efforts to have new sanctions on Iran?
Yes, I think it will make it more difficult to particularly convince China and Russia to go along with new sanctions. In fact, China's ambassador to the United Nations was saying yesterday that we are reading this report very carefully, because this is a new date, this is a new information, and in the light of new information, we may have to revise our standing with regards to Iran nuclear weapon program. Remember, Vladimir Putin, president of Russia, just said a few weeks ago that there is absolutely no evidence that Iran has any nuclear weapon program, and therefore there is no reason for ratcheting up the pressure on Iran and trying to impose new sanctions. With this new estimate, which is, by the way, by 16 U.S. intelligence organizations, it would be far more difficult to convince at least China and Russia to go along with new sanctions.
Now, the lead up to the war with Iraq showed that the media can have a pretty serious impact on helping a government create the case for war. Have you had a chance to take a look at the mainstream media coverage of this intelligence report? What is your assessment in general, even, of how the mainstream media has been covering the U.S. Push towards war with Iran?
I've been following what the mainstream media has been saying, and I must say that I still find big faults in what they report. For example, they don't question the assertion that Iran had a secret nuclear weapon program before 2003. Where is the evidence for it? We have never seen any hard physical evidence that Iran actually had this program before 2003. This is another aspect of what the mainstream media does. They just go along with whatever the administration say. So it is important, in my view, to have programs like yours, for example, that tries to bring the best, most complete, and most objective information to the view of the public.
At the same time, it seems as though the mainstream media has taken this report quite seriously. The Washington Post had a front page article calling their article was headlined "A Blow to Bush's Tehran Policy." It seems as though they are this is not a report that is disappearing into the back pages of the newspapers, if you know what I mean.
Oh, I agree. I mean, there is no question, because they have been confronted with stark facts. The 16 U.S. intelligence organizations say Iran stopped its nuclear weapon program in 2003, and this is almost 2008. So that means almost 5 years ago, Iran stopped its program. So this is not something that can be ignored, and as you said, this is not something that is going to disappear tomorrow or the next week. But at the same time, as I said, the mainstream media do not look at the report critically and critique those aspects that seem to be based on mainly assertion without presenting any evidence, including the fact that the National Intelligence Estimate says that Iran did have a nuclear weapon program before 2003 without presenting any hard evidence.
Finally, Professor Sahimi, what next? What do you think the Bush administration is going to do next? What do you think the Iranian government is going to do next? And on that latter question, it seems as though Mahmoud Ahmadinejad really doesn't have to do much else except sit and watch the Bush administration back off.
I think the Bush administration will try to convince the members of United Nations Security Council to go along with the third round of sanctions against Iran. But I believe it would be much more difficult to do it. Iran, on the other hand, has been saying for a long time that Iran's nuclear dossier should be returned to International Atomic Energy Agency rather than being in United Nations Security Council. And once it is there, which in my view is its rightful place, it should be there. It shouldn't have been sent to the United Nations Security Council because Iran's nuclear program never posed any threat to international peace and security. Once it is there, then negotiation can start. Iran has hinted that if its nuclear dossier is returned to the agency, it will be willing to seriously consider a temporary suspension of uranium enrichment program in return for serious negotiation to reach an agreement. So I believe the Iranian government would insist on that, and I believe the Bush administration will insist on imposing a new round of sanctions on Iran because it claims that these sanctions are having an effect and Iranian government is changing its behavior.
And inside Iran, what about civil society groups, particularly those who are active in opposing their own government? Is this basically going to create more space for them to now, not have to worry about a U.S. attack, or has it just made the government stronger?
Well, Shirin Ebadi, the Iranian lady who won the 2003 Nobel Peace Prize, announced the formation of a peace group a few weeks ago. And this peace group is basically a broad coalition of many political parties, journalists, university students, poets, writers, and so on, to oppose the nuclear program of government of President Ahmadinejad. I believe this will make them stronger in the sense that they would say, look, there is no urgency. The international community now is better convinced that this is a peaceful activity. We can afford to suspend the uranium enrichment program that we have for a short time in order to create more trust between Iran's program and the international community. And in fact, that's what they have been saying for the past several weeks. So in that sense, I believe it will provide the political cover for Iran's NGOs and moderate and reformist political group to pressure the government of President Ahmadinejad to back down from its insistence on continuing the uranium enrichment program without any suspension, temporary suspension. So in that sense, it's also good news for Iranian NGO, in my view.
Well, Mohammad Sahimi, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure to be in your program.
Professor Sahimi is a professor of chemical engineering at the University of Southern California. We've been discussing the U.S. intelligence report on Iran. And for Sonali, subversive thought for the day, I coincidentally have a quote from Shirin Ebadi, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, who once said, "No American soldier should be allowed to set foot on Iranian soil, regardless of the criticism we have of the Iranian government." That's Shirin Ebadi, and that's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer and also helped to direct today's show. You can hear an audio stream of today's show after 10 a.m. on our website at uprisingradio.org. Our email is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks for listening.